Welcome to podcast number 66 of My Favorite Detective Stories. Today's date is September 10th, 2019, and I'm your host, John A. Hoda. Our guest this week is Harvey Morse. Harvey E. Morse began his investigative career in Massachusetts after graduating Boston University and then attending Suffolk University Law School. In approximately 1975, he moved to Florida and commenced operations as president of Locators International, Inc., which has been actively engaged in traditional investigations since it was founded. He's also the founder of the Florida Association of Private Investigators, Inc., and is a multi-state certified firearms instructor for concealed carry. He continues to serve on many civic, charitable, law enforcement, and private investigation organization boards. He has over 50 years of investigative experience. Harvey also graduated the full Florida Police Academy, first in his class of 82 candidates, and is a sworn law enforcement officer, having been an assistant chief and currently serves as a police investigator. Welcome to My Favorite Detective Stories. My Favorite Detective Stories features successful private investigators. They offer insights into their careers and advice to those just starting out or to those who are struggling. You will learn from the best. Of course, we cannot finish the show without asking them to share their favorite detective story. On alternating weeks, you will hear from crime fiction writers who discuss their latest books and what makes their fictional detectives tick. Throughout my investigative career spanning five decades, I cannot think of a time that I didn't have a good crime novel on my coffee table or bedstand. We will also talk about their favorite authors as well. As a working investigator, coach, and writer, I hope to bring inspiration, information, and entertainment in the areas that interest me most. Gather around my campfire as I invite you to listen in. Hi, Harvey. Welcome to the show.
Hey, John. Good morning.
So how's life in Waynesville, North Carolina today?
Well, today's a beautiful day. It's about 77 degrees right now, and that's no humidity degrees.
Oh, that's sweet.
Sun is shining, and it's going to be a gorgeous day.
Well, I won't keep you too long on this Saturday morning. As we recorded, it is August 31st. Not quite into September yet, but we are on the Labor Day weekend. So life is good up here for me in Connecticut. I live in Milford, Connecticut, and I'm along the coast between Bridgeport and New Haven, and it's a glorious day as well. So I won't keep you long on the podcast today, Harvey, but you know, our listeners do want to hear about why you decided to become a PI in the first place, and tell us about your journey.
Well, my journey is probably a little bit unique and perhaps a little bit different than most folks in the PI industry today. I am a product of a family business. I was born and raised in Boston, you know, not all that far from you. Mm-hmm. I went to college and law school there. I am not an attorney, but I did go to law school. And my grandfather started a business in 1939 during the Great Depression of locating missing and unknown heirs to estates. My father went into the business, my uncle went into the business, and I was destined to also go into the business. I've always loved investigations, and I've always loved photography. Photography relates because I worked my way through college and law school taking photographs primarily of automobile accidents. Because I'm a radio ham, I had all these scanners and amateur radio equipment at my home, and I'd hear a car crash, and I'd run out with my camera, and I'd take the pictures of the scene, and after a while, the police were saying, well, just anybody wants any photos, get a hold of Harvey. He must have been here.
Wow.
And then I get into some investigation of the automobile crashes, and soon was retained by the Department of Transportation as a vehicular homicide investigator.
Really?
Yes. And I did that for around 10 to maybe 10, 11 years. I had to go to the scene of every fatal automobile accident in Massachusetts and then all truck accidents, ICC accidents, in all the New England states. And they couldn't move the vehicles, or if there was a fatality there, the bodies, until I actually arrived and did my thing.
Wow.
So I had that going for me on one side, and then entering the family business, doing a different type of investigation. And when I started out, John, there were no databases, there were no computers, there were no anything. We used the good old R.L. Polk city directories to find people and to learn where people lived. We used to go to libraries and crawl up and down shelves where these books were stored. And everything was on the ground, face to face. No computers. You needed to find somebody. You went to an address. You spoke with neighbors. You checked voting lists, police lists, a lot of things that exist today, but most private investigators don't even know those things exist.
No, you're right. And I understand the business. As you know, I was in the missing air research business for a short period of time. But for those listeners, there was two needs. There would be the needs your company would find the missing heirs and then connect them to the estates, and your business would do that for a fee, and you would also help them with their attorney costs to make sure that they got all the money that they were supposed to do. When they got all their money, then they would pay you your contingency fee based upon having found them and brought them to the estate for the first place. Am I right?
You're 100% right. And what it did, John, you just need to think about this. It combined my interest in the law, that would be the signing the contract and the laws of the state in which a decedent died, to meeting people and the investigation to find them.
Right.
So I put all of those elements together in my life, all the things that I enjoyed doing.
That's so true. And the other aspect of missing air research, too, is that you would be hired by an attorney to then go out on a hourly fee or some sort of a set schedule to locate all the people that were related to the decedent and then create the family tree. So that would be the other aspect of it as well. So
well, plus worldwide travel. I mean, I have literally been all over the world, from Ukraine, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, France, Germany, I can go on and on, conducting investigations in those countries from a forensic genealogical perspective.
Oh, and you're right on. You're spot on. I only mentioned this, and I didn't want to take away from your business formation or your talking about your business, only to explain to our listeners what a very unique niche is of missing heir research and how lucrative it could be, especially when somebody's died with a ton of money, but unfortunately didn't take out a will. And it then becomes obvious that the missing heirs have to be located and located quickly. You're not doing this in a vacuum either. You're out there competing against other missing heir research firms that are trying to locate those persons and sign them up to their contracts as well. So there's a lot of excitement in the in the chase. And the chase is a good word, you know, so.
Chase is a good word, and there's nothing like ending up on the doorstep with a competitor ringing the doorbell together trying to get an heir to sign a contract.
Oh, Harvey, that would be fun. I never had that happen with me, thankfully. Most of my contacts were done telephonically, and then I would follow up with a priority mailer. But I could imagine you're standing there, and then I won't mention the other company's names, but nor were you. But to be standing there next to your buddy, who you might have seen in the probate court, or you might have seen at the registry doing a search for a birth or a marriage or death records, now is also on the hunt with you as well, and they've gotten to the same place as you did. So that's funny. So
that's the term negotiation comes into play.
Absolutely.
You meet with that person and you say, hey, let's not argue, let's not fight, let's work together, and let's split our feet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, genuinely, you both ended up at the same place at the same time, so why not?
And that's the gentlemanly way to do it. And then split attorney's fees too as well for the attorney that would have to represent the parties in the probate case. Just to let our listeners know, you know, if they think that probate court is like a white shoe, you know, a very sedate court activity, it can be as raucous as any criminal defense case or any civil case involving lots of money. Anytime you have a lot of money and you have family passion involved, this could be just as exciting a courtroom drama as any other type of courtroom drama there is. I came into the missing heir research thinking that probate court was kind of genteel. Wow, that was a that was an eye opener for me. So
I mean, right now we're working on the Jeffrey Epstein estate. We've worked on the Prince estate. I represent Darryl Brown, the son of the singer James Brown. We've had Novak family from the Fountain Blue Hotel in Miami and the murders that were involved in that. So we've been very fortunate to be working on some very high profile cases, and it keeps us in the media, and it's just fascinating. It's
sure.
Absolutely fascinating.
So you were part of your family business, and I understand that part, and at some point you took it over, but you also created another business when you moved to Florida. Do I understand that right?
About 1972 or so, I said, I've had it with the cold, and I've had it with the snow, and I sold my snowblower and said, I'm moving to Florida. And I moved to Orlando, and one of the reasons I moved to Orlando was because I had this incredibly loving relationship with my grandfather, who started the missing heir business. And he said, Harvey, you know, we don't want to see you move, but if you're going to move, you may want to Florida. You may want to consider the Orlando area. And I said, why? And he said, well, unlike Massachusetts, Florida's a real big geographical state, and you can get to most parts of it in a day if you put yourself in the center of the state. Well, obviously that made a lot of sense. And, you know, everybody thinks Miami and the glitz and all that.
Right.
I was going there for the business. I wasn't going there for retirement or enjoyment. And what he said made sense and proved to be very, very true. So I went there and opened a business called Locators International, Inc., and obtained my private investigative license. And that was a little bit interesting because my uncle thought that I would then become a competitor to the rest of the family, which I suppose I was, but not in the sense that I was out to, you know, do any harm or do anything improper. But nevertheless, he filed an objection that I wasn't quite a private investigator in Florida. And I represented myself at the hearing. And the state hearings officer said, no, we understand. It's a family competitive issue. And, you know, Harvey's certainly entitled to his license. And my license was granted. And what was really interesting, how I went from an objection to being qualified to having a private investigator's license to actually heading the state's Private Security Advisory Council as its chairperson for 10 consecutive years, which, as you know, oversaw the issuance of statutory the changes and rules of all private investigators, repossessed polygraph operators, and armored car guards and security guards in the whole state of Florida. So I went from one extreme to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed my days on that quasi governmental body.
Sure. So what was the original model of Locators International? What were you looking to do? Who was your target audience? How were you going to make money?
My original plan was to open the private investigative agency and do genealogical work as well, because genealogical work is as nice as or as unusual as it may sound. You can locate an heir today of an estate that was filed today, but not be paid for 2 or 3 years down the road.
Sure.
So I needed something that was immediate. I mean, I was married, I had 3 kids, and I needed to have an immediate source of income, and private investigation allowed that to happen. And the most difficult thing at first was becoming established. Now, when I moved to Orlando, it was nothing like Orlando is today. Today, Orlando's a big city.
And that was pre-Disney, right? In 72?
Just about when Disney opened.
Oh, that's right.
Just about. So I had to do some unique things to get recognized. It was not that there were a lot of private investigators in the greater Orlando area, but I needed to find a way to stand out. And the first thing I did was I would go to the courthouse, and there was a coffee shop in the courthouse, and all the lawyers would go there before trial or just to, you know, converse with one another. And I would be in that room. And it was a little bit aggressive, perhaps. I'd hear a lawyer talking about something and, you know, you couldn't find somebody or something. I go, excuse me, I couldn't help overhearing what you were saying. I'm a private investigator. Could I be of any help? And that helped me get in with the legal community. Plus, I was able to understand the language they spoke, having, you know, been to law school.
Right. That was brilliant, Harvey. I mean, it really was. Because, you know, if you want to market to lawyers, you go where they are.
And
you,
exactly.
And a coffee shop at a courthouse before court in the morning, and they're thinking about how their case is going to go, and they're thinking about what they have to prepare for, and they know they might not have all the evidence that they need. But you come along as a private investigator, and you say to them, hey, I can be of assistance. Wonderful
right.
idea.
And the next thing I did that I say I think helped, but I'm not really sure because I did receive a few nasty letters. I obtained a copy of a summons, a court summons. You know, it's a standard form. Mm-hmm. And I sent one to all the lawyers in Greater Orlando, summonsing them to do business with my firm. It was sent out as an actual summons would be sent out in the mail, not hand delivered.
Right.
And it was, the responses were very interesting. The lawyer got it and would say, what am I getting a summons for? And then he'd read it, and most of them got a kick out of it. A couple of people were upset saying I shouldn't have done it, but I still got their attention, didn't I?
Yes, you did. And okay, I like it a lot, and it's a direct mail piece that got the thing opened and got the thing read. And I think most of the people would tell you that, or most of the attorneys would tell you they appreciated your what's the word, chutzpah?
Yeah, that would do it.
And I think that's a good word, and I think that explains it. And then you got their attention, so that was a fantastic marketing piece. Certainly better than the Yellow Pages, for sure.
Oh yeah, and it got them talking about me. You know, I'd see them now in the coffee shop. Are you the guy that sent out that summons to my office? You know, my secretary went crazy until she started reading it. We didn't know what it was. So it worked out really well. And that's how I actually broke ground and got in with the legal community. But of course, I wanted to be in with the business community as well. You know, being a private investigator, your sources of clientele are not just attorneys, but average everyday people. So I did have some ads in the Yellow Pages. Mm-hmm. And at that time in Florida, they had a Yellow Page category for investigators and a Yellow Page category for private investigators. And I went to battle with the Yellow Pages. Why are you making us spend all this money? It's the same category. Can't you combine them into one category? Well, eventually they did. And that helped save a few bucks. You know, when you're starting out, the dollars are very, very important.
Oh, yeah. You got to throw the nickels around like manhole covers. You know,
that's right. And you want to project a very professional image. And that is what I always strived for, to be professional and to do away with the TV image. Back in those days, you know, the private investigators always outsmarted law enforcement. Well, that's just not the way that it is in reality. And I'm trying to dispel that image by saying, hey, I'm an investigator. I feel I can do a good job. I'm not here to outsmart anybody. I'm just a magnet, and I get dropped in the middle of a situation. I gather the facts, and then I spit them back in a chronological order as however they might be. Mm-hmm. So I'm not adding material. I'm not taking away material. I'm presenting something to my client, or whether it's a lawyer or just a regular citizen. And I'm saying, this is what I found. So that's basically how I started. One of the funniest experiences, I think my very first case involving a business person was a dentist, and he was dealing with an infidelity situation. And in those days, you could bug houses, offices, there were never a problem. And being a radio amateur, I had a little bit of experience with electronics. You could go to the Radio Shack in those days and buy these little microphones and stick them in wall outlets and all that, which I did. And this dentist was doing more for his case than I was. He was telling me what he wanted me to do. And I learned a lot. It was somewhat embarrassing. But that was my very first case, and it worked out well. He got what he wanted, and that's what my first case was. And then I ended up in an office building, and there was a homicide of a bunch of people on a boat in the Bahamas, and the landlord of my building was friendly with those people. The family hired me, and I went to get something at my office at about 2-3 in the morning, and found the landlord in my office scurrying through my papers.
Really?
Yeah, that was something. I moved out the next morning, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
The case is unsolved to this day, but I think he had something to do with it. But that's beside the point. So, and then John, I got it, you know, in my investigatory experience from the federal vehicular homicide investigator, I said, well, I might as well go to the police academy while I'm doing this. So I did.
Really?
So I went to the Florida Police Academy. I managed to graduate first in my class of 82 students. And I think I cried the first day after the physical therapy with the running and the pains and the aches. I was 49 when I graduated the police academy, so most of the students could have been a child.
They probably called you pops just to give you a hard time. Yeah,
they did. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then I went on to be a reserve a state trooper, and the director summons me up to Tallahassee, and I wrote a lot of policies and procedures for the Florida Highway Patrol. And then I kept my certification by being a deputy sheriff, and eventually became an assistant police chief in Volusia County. But all the time maintaining my business. Now, some people listening may say, well, how can you be in law enforcement and be in the private sector at the same time? Florida Department of Law Enforcement does not care if you have a private investigative license and are a law enforcement officer. It is the agency that makes the determination whether they think there's a conflict of interest or not. So what I did, I nipped it in the bud. My agency to this day, because I am still sworn, does not handle criminal cases. So I stopped. When I went to the police academy, I had done 47 homicide investigations in Florida myself for the defense. And after going to the police academy, I ceased doing any criminal work whatsoever. So, and that's the way that it has been for probably the last 30, 35 years.
No.
We just handle civil matters.
And, you know, it's interesting because during the time period that I was doing my missing heir research, I also had a few very loyal criminal defense attorneys in New Haven that were giving me work. So I'd be working on trying to find heirs, like you say, in Lithuania, but I was also beating the mean streets of New Haven trying to track down witnesses for a homicide case. I mean, what a different, you know, totally different world, but, you know, they both require knowing your case and knowing your objective and knowing what skill sets you need to get the job done. So I just really...
The things I learned at the police academy, I have to tell you, made me the investigator that I am today. I like to think of in the industry, and I've served on I don't know how many boards as president. I've written statutes in Florida for the private investigative industry. And a lot that I learned at the police academy was what set me apart from the average private investigator who either was self-taught or came from a military background or was interning with somebody to learn how to become a private investigator. And that was a great thing. I would highly recommend anybody that is thinking about being a private investigator, if they can work around a schedule that would allow them to go to a police academy just to learn what the real part of life is all about in the investigative world, and makes you a great witness, I might add, when you're on the witness stand and people ask for your biography.
Yeah, the thinking behind what you're saying is it's almost like going to a technical school, right? I mean, if you want to be a electrician, you got to go to a school that teaches electricians, you know, and that's just a great example. I think I like that a lot. So
it was the college course of becoming a private investigator by going to the police academy. And you can't go to work. Well, in my day, you could not go to a school and learn how to become a private investigator. Nothing like that existed. So this was the closest and best way to learn. And then you got to see what the law enforcement sector would do when they conducted an investigation and what you could and couldn't do from what you learned in that experience. So I'm thrilled that I did that.
And you continue to this day still to be a law enforcement person.
Correct. Yeah, I'm still a reserve deputy sheriff.
Wow, that's fantastic. Now, at one point you had an office down in Daytona Beach?
Yes. My office in Daytona, my office started out in a city called Winter Park, Florida. And where I lived in the early formative days of Orlando, it would take me about 15 minutes to get to my office. Well, when I looked at my watch and found that the same drive was taking me 45 minutes, I said, I think it's time to move. And I moved to Daytona Beach, Florida, where the commute time again went back to my 10, 15 minutes. So that's what I did. I just got tired of the traffic and everything else. But I maintained an office in Orlando staffed by other people. So I did not give up any of the clientele or any of the business connections that I established there. And in fact, made Orlando a branch office of my Daytona office, which became our headquarters.
Okay. Now, it sounds like, you know, you were at the right place at the right time, did a lot of good things, did a lot of good marketing. Were there any things that you learned from the hard way?
Boy, I'm telling you, we probably could do a 3-4 hour show on all on what I learned the hard way. Every mistake is really a learning opportunity, and you can't even call them mistakes. There are just things that happen. You're under surveillance and you get made. Things that you don't have an awful lot of control over. Mm-hmm. But a lot of those things mistakes can be avoided by actually sitting down and thinking them out and asking yourself what could go wrong and try to have a contingent plan for when something does happen that you may have thought of but didn't think would ever happen. Mistakes are inevitable, and I really find it hard to call them mistakes. They're learning experiences, they're circumstances that happened, and not necessarily a mistake. A mistake would be if you did a report on an investigative matter or on a domestic case and you sent the report to the wrong client. That's a mistake. But learning how to do your things, your investigations, and things that can go wrong, when they do, that's not a mistake. That's life.
No, you're right. And one of the examples I like to point to in my world was I had all this experience from locating missing heirs from all over the world. And I had gotten pretty good at locating people, locally as well. And I had a lot of good skill sets with location. And I thought that, gee, wouldn't it be neat if I could create a business that I could go high end with, where I would go to the top corporations of the country and say to them, you know, in your litigations, when you absolutely positively have to find that missing witness or party to a case, you'd hire me. And I thought about that. I thought that'd be a great way to use my skill sets to go and leverage them to a larger and, of course, a repeat audience, because after all, they have lots and lots of those cases. Well, I'm glad I did what you just suggested, Harvey, because rather than just jump all in about it, I thought about it and I said, you know, let me just test the waters a little bit here with this. And it turns out that the Fortune 100 didn't need me to be their high-end locator because they were satisfied with the tools and the people that they had already. And even if they didn't get the results they wanted, they weren't real interested in changing. You know, they didn't feel enough pain in order to want to change the way they were doing the business. Well, I saved myself a ton of money, obviously, by not going all in. You know, I didn't burn my bridges. I didn't burn the ships behind me. And I just looked at that. It was a proof of concept. And I disproved the concept. And I saved myself a lot of money in the meantime. And I think your advice is just spot on about thinking it through before you go and make that major expenditure or make that change in your business model or make that want to take on a new line of work. All of those things, if you just sit and think it through, maybe it sounds like it's a nice idea, but if you really take the time with it and test it out, you'll save yourself some money in the long run.
One of the things, John, I tried and I found it to be unsuccessful was I was doing a ton of work for a lot of attorneys, and I had some good people that I had brought on to work with me. And I came up with the idea that to kill the dead spots when your business didn't have any real great amounts of cases in the pot going on, that how about sending out a letter to the lawyers and basically saying, look, give me X dollars per month, keep me on retainer for the X dollars, I will do so many hours of work. For work beyond the X hours, you would receive a discount. And had a graduated scale ranging from 5 hours a month to 10 or 20 hours a month. and the, you know, the retainer, the monthly retainer would obviously be higher for the greater amount of time. And I could not sell that to the attorneys, no matter how hard I try. They wanted me on an as-needed basis. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to be spending money to keep me available. And sometimes, you know, you had to say, I'm sorry, I can't work on your case till another couple of weeks go by. But if you were on retainer with me, yeah, we'd figure something out. But that never worked. I could not get that to happen. And I just think that the way things are these days with everybody watching their money, that was a hard one to try to sell. But I tried it. But again, we're talking probably in the 80s now.
Mm-hmm.
But I could not get that one across. It always reverted back to an hourly or daily rate.
And to your point, there are some law firms who have enough of a certain type of business in a dense enough area that they can have their own PI on staff. And that PI is a jack of all trades, you know, picks up police reports, goes to accident scenes, signs up with clients, does the investigations because they have enough volume in that area to justify it. But not every law firm is that way. And I think that's what you finally came to the conclusion.
Yeah. And I have to blame Florida statute on that. They allow an exemption for a law firm to have an in-house investigator or as many in-house investigators as they want, but they can only work for that one law firm.
Right.
If they kept it strict to the books and said, no, a private investigator has to have a license, et cetera, that would have been better for the business as a whole. But, you know, certain things you have to deal with, and that's just one of them.
Yeah, in our state of Connecticut, too, up here, persons are able to do investigations under the if they're an employee of a law firm, working for that law firm. So they might not have a spit of investigative experience, but they can do what we normally do as private investigators out in the field because of that exemption as well.
And as I'm seeing this happening more and more, though, John, especially in Florida. For example, Florida private investigators are governed by the Division of Licensing. It used to be under the Secretary of State. Now it's under the Department of Agriculture. Background investigations would always be for licensed private investigators. Now there's an exemption for people that just do a certain type of background investigation. The same thing with shopping services. They used to be reserved for private investigators only. Now there's an exemption for shopping services. So I'm sitting back watching the dilution of the private investigative profession to the point where there are so many exemptions and exclusions from licensure that it really is hurting the industry.
Well, not only the industry, but in the end, the consumer, right?
Correct.
Because,
absolutely,
you know, a private investigator with the skill sets and the background, doing a background check will charge X number of dollars. And that work being done requires not only doing database research and open source intelligence gathering, but also, you know, a fair degree of shoe leather, knocking on doors, talking to people, going to repositories that are not digitized yet. And to your point, the information brokers or those backgrounders that are just doing it online are giving that information to a client and making it look like it's a complete or full background. And yet, when the thing blows up in their face because they might have made a bad hiring decision or they might have done business with a party that was that were thieves, it just shows that the quality of the investigation was surface and it wasn't in depth at all. And they ended up not getting what they paid for. They ended up getting a lawsuit or a negligence or some other problem.
And look at the tenant screeners. I mean, these are people that are just using databases to make a decision whether you as a landlord should bring this person in as a tenant into one of your properties. Mm-hmm. And you know, everybody says, well, I want to know if they have a criminal history. Well, you know, and I know that the only way to find out if somebody has a true criminal history is from NCIC, which is not available to private investigators. It's not available to the general public.
Right.
So they're giving information to prospective landlords that may not always be accurate. For example, they may scan a person's name in newspapers to see if there was ever an arrest. Well, that's not a criminal history check. And then you have a few places in the United States that don't even report to NCIC. Mm. So there is no 100% accuracy as when you say somebody does or does not have a criminal history.
Oh, you're right.
So these are the things that the less experienced investigators make happen. And then the citizen says, well, I hired a private investigator to do my tenant screening. No, you didn't. You hired a tenant screener. And because you got bad information, you're now blaming the whole private investigative profession.
Right. Now, I understand that it's a fine balance that we walk between trying to protect the investigative industry, sort of like a guild, you know, back in the days when guild craftsmen held, you know, such high esteem, you know, because of rigorous standards by which they went about their guild work. But on the other hand, there has to be the balance too with economics. And I think that the wise private investigator and the wise private investigative firm is able to do guild-like work, but do it in such a way that their processes are so, I don't want to use the word seamless, it sounds like a buzzword, but that the processes are so honed that they can drive down the cost of doing the work that they do and still supply a quality product. So I think that's the balance. And I think that's something that our listeners can learn from is if they can learn to do a job really, really well and then cut out all the extra steps that slow down the process or add cost to the process that don't add value to the client, that's the best. That's the sweet spot, I would think.
I do agree with you. And if I may give your listeners one tip, mm-hmm. do not work on any case as a private investigator unless you have a written contract with the client. I don't care if the attorney is a friend of yours, if the client is a friend of yours, a non-attorney, but you must have a contract.
It's not difficult, right? It's
correct.
Hey, I got the assignment. I understand everything. Let me put it into a contract form for you. Let me send it back to you, right?
And one of the things, yes, John, one of the things you must specify is the client's objective. If you don't specify the client's objective, you will never know when you've reached the end of the contract.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I see this happen time and time, and then people, private investigators, then get into litigation with their client, and it's all because they didn't specify what the client wanted in a contract and that the contract was devoid of certain hold harmless agreements, error and omission agreements and things like that that would make life so much easier if the private investigator spent a reasonable amount of time, hired an attorney, made a contract, and set a policy within their company, no case shall be worked without a written contract.
Okay. Good advice, Harvey. That's fantastic. And any other advice that you have for anybody starting out in this profession at this point?
The only thing I would say is I love mentoring new private investigators. I like to stand there as the grandfather looking over their shoulder and tell me, what would you do? What would you think about doing it this way? Try and connect yourself with somebody that has been a private investigator for a while, that has a great reputation that is a respected private investigator, not some hokey guy that, you know, is the old TV image of a private investigator. Connect with that person, become friendly with them, ask them questions, and if the person is a decent individual, they will see that you are trying to learn and they will help you. And that's the best way to learn the business.
And the way to meet the seasoned pro like yourself or myself, go to your state association meetings, go to the international conferences that deal with private investigations, and talk to the teachers that are teaching the classes afterwards. Offer to buy them a cup of coffee or a drink. Sit down and talk to them about what your goals and aspirations are. And then strike up a conversation. Get a business card. Exchange business cards. Be available to help them out when they need somebody to do something. It's the only way that you're going to grow in your profession. It's the only way you're not only. It's going to be one of the several ways to grow in your profession. But to think that, you know, as a young or a new investigator starting out, that you know everything, that's the recipe for disaster.
That's 100% true.
Especially when it comes to business, you know, how to go about marketing for your business, how to go about creating your business so that one can sustain, but also your field craft. That's as important as well, because you're only as good as the job that you can do. So,
and also don't forget to do some things at no charge that have a great marketing value. Do some work for the Humane Society. Do some work for hospice. Do some work for the community where you're not charging anybody for anything, but you're getting yourself out there and you're gaining respect. You know, join the Chamber of Commerce. Give a speech about something. Become the expert in everybody's eyes.
Oh, absolutely.
That's how you build your business.
All great advice, Harvey. And I think that, you know, sometimes people are a little reticent to try to do that. But did it hurt to sit and have a cup of coffee in a courthouse when you were back in the early 70s down in Orlando? Didn't hurt you at all. Did you ruffle a few feathers? Okay. But did it get you business? Did it get you started? Right.
Exactly. Right.
Now, that volunteer work, it cuts two ways. The volunteer work is worthwhile and fulfilling in and by itself. But if you're doing showcasing some of your skills in a volunteer setting, there are higher ups. There's boards of directors. There's people that are in the business community that value and see what you're doing and see the value of what you're doing and can then apply that to a paying situation because they've already had a chance to experience you in a non-pay situation.
And they see you in a different light. They see you as an experienced professional willing to do something to help somebody, not necessarily for compensation, just because it's the right thing to do.
And to your point, I took on some work with the public defender's office here in New Haven. I wouldn't call it pro bono. I would call it low bono.
Yeah.
I was paid 21% of my normal rate, but it gave me an opportunity to showcase my investigative skills to boutique law firms throughout the greater New Haven area that when the opportunity presented themselves to have me work for their full pay clients, they naturally had they knew, like, and trusted me from the work that I did on my low bono work. So don't turn.
Look what it did for your resume. When you put your resume and you said, you know, I'm an investigator for the public defender's office, mm-hmm. you know, you're elevating yourself. Your resume is of tremendous value. And when you do things, even at no charge, but now have something to add to your resume, that's money in the bank in the future.
That's a great way of looking at it. And I think that our listeners should pay a lot of attention to that because it seems like, oh, it's free. I'm not going to get paid for it. But look at the value that you get from having that on your, like you say, your resume or your even on your website or your curriculum vitae. All very, very important, building up that body of work that you can attest to and that other people can attest to on your behalf. So we're getting to that point, Harvey, it's getting kind of long in our podcast today, but where are you at now, and where do you plan to be in the future with your businesses, and what's the future hold for Harvey?
Well, I am very fortunate that, as I told you at the very beginning, I stepped into a family-owned business, not exactly doing private investigations, but genealogical research, and I was the third generation in the business. And now my nephew, Ari Morse, he's been in the business with me for around 22, 23 years, and he will be the next generation to carry on the business.
That's fantastic.
So I'm here as his mentor, a mentor to our other investigators that we have on staff, many of whom are retired FBI agents. And I look at all the affidavits. I read and proof all the affidavits that go out of our office. I testify as an expert witness on both investigative law enforcement and forensic genealogy. And that's where I am today, you know, just in the life circle, getting ready to pass it on off to my nephew, who is very, very competent and I know will do an excellent job carrying the torch for the next generation.
And you know, it's the first time we've talked in many, many years. We've been in similar circles over the years, probably been at investigator conferences and never had a chance to say hello. I'm so happy you came on the podcast for me today. And I'm so happy that you have this advice for aspiring investigators, people that want to get their businesses started and or are struggling in their private investigations business. And I also appreciate the fact that you want to leave a legacy yourself about thanking the industry for all the things that it's given you. And now, in a way, you're giving back. And I really appreciate that. So thank you for coming on. And
it's been my pleasure.
How can people reach you, Harvey? Because if they have any other further questions, they want to talk to the master, they should be able to get in touch with you.
They can get me at our office in Florida. The main number is area code 386-760-5000. Or they can email me. And my email address is Harvey, H-A-R-V-E-Y, at probate, probate.com. The same as the probate court, Harvey at probate.com. And I'll be more than happy to respond to any of your listeners.
All right. On that note, thank you so much.
And a pleasure.
Likewise.
Thank you for listening. I hope that I've earned your interest and your time. Please leave any comments on the website, www.johnhoda.com. That's JohnHoda.com. Our guest next week is Renee Denfield. Renee was the chief investigator at a public defender's office and has worked hundreds of cases, including death row exonerations and helping rape trafficking victims escape their captors. In addition to her advocacy work, Renee has been a foster adoptive parent for 20 years. She was awarded the Break the Silence Award in Washington, D.C. for her social justice work and was named a 2017 Hero of the Year by the New York Times. Renee is an author of the acclaimed novels Child Finder, The Enchanted, and The Butterfly Girl. Her literary thrillers explore themes of survival, resiliency, and redemption and have earned starred library journal reviews, glowing New York Times bestseller reviews, and indie next books. Margaret Atwood has proclaimed her work astonishing, and The Butterfly Girl is a heartbreaking, finger-gnawing, yet ultimately hopeful novel. Child of a difficult history herself, Renee is an accomplished speaker who loves connecting with others. Renee lives in Portland, Oregon, where she is a happy mom of three kids adopted from foster care, as well as other foster kids. This is an episode not to be missed. This episode is brought to you by my recently published books for private investigators. How to launch your private investigation business. How to market your private investigation business. And how to boost your private investigation business. They also appear as a three-book set in How to Rocket Your Private Investigation Business, the complete series. All can be found at your favorite online retailers in ebook or softcover. Did you know that I also coach private investigators how to survive and thrive in business? Visit my website at www.thepicoach.com. That is thepicoach.com to learn more. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear other great detective stories, please go to the website and click on our podcast page. There you'll find the backlist. Now, you're probably asking, John, what about your own stories? Do you have any? Sure enough, I do. And they are available to you free as a download right to your inbox. I have 8 short stories and 8 vignettes in a book titled Mugshots, My Favorite Detective Stories. Now, here's my ask. If you were either informed, inspired, or entertained by the stories today, don't be bashful. Share this link with your friends. Better still, go to the iTunes website and leave a review. It's the best way to grow the circle around our campfire. If you have any questions, please contact me through the website, www.johnhoda.com, J-O-H-N-H-O-D-A.com. Thanks so much, and have a great day.